Hello, SunSouth listeners. This is Andy Bobick, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I've been reading now for maybe over 3 months. That also happens to be the 2024 Newbery Award-winning book given to the best children's book every year, titled The Eyes and the Impossible. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Lumberjacks Love Pancakes. And then it's Aisha's Colors, Daddy Sitting, Very Lulu, The Mostly True Story of a Training School Dropout About a Dog, Georgie Dupree, Classroom Confidence, and if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with Basking in My Brown. So, it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled Lumberjacks Love Pancakes. Bobby lay on his cot, sleeping peacefully. He was dreaming his usual dream of pancakes. Big, fluffy pancakes covered in syrup. Tall stacks, short stacks, large cakes, small cakes. He dreamt about any kind. After all, lumberjacks love pancakes. On this particular morning, Bobby jumped up in a panic. He could already smell delicious, sweet pancakes. But, oh no, they started breakfast, and he was late. "Gone," Bobby said. All the pancakes were gone. A lumberjack knows to never be late for breakfast, because lumberjacks love pancakes. Oh, those delicious, fluffy, sweet pancakes. Bobby hurried back to his tent. He had work to do if he didn't want to miss them again. He would have to finish all his jobs so he could get his pancakes for dinner. Bobby entered his tent to grab his axe, but all he found was a mess. He'd never find his axe in this disaster. There was Bobby's axe. He picked it up and headed toward the river where the other lumberjacks were working. Bobby slipped his climbing spikes over his boots, quickly picked a tree, and started to climb. Bobby climbed quickly to catch up to the other tree toppers so that he could make it back in time for pancakes. Bobby quickly started chopping off the top of the tree. "Yo-ho!" he called out. Bobby cheered and started to slide down the tree, but then he realized he forgot to saw off the limbs on his way up. Bobby jumped off the trunk of the tree and looked up to see the newly made pole. Bobby needed to saw it down quickly so he could get the trunk into the river. He looked around, but all the other lumberjacks were busy. "I can do it alone," he thought to himself, grabbing a one-man saw to get started. The sharp saw moved through the wood quickly at first, but Bobby was growing tired from having to chop his way down the tree. All Bobby could think about was getting to his pancakes. Bobby's arms started to slow, and the saw barely moved. Oh no, it looked like Bobby needs some help. With a loud crack, the tree began to fall, but it was falling away from the river. How would he get the log down the river to the mill? Bobby felt the ground shake as the log crashed down. Bobby tried to push the log toward the river, but it wouldn't move. He tried to pull it and kick it, and he leaned his back up against it, but the log wouldn't budge. If Bobby didn't hurry, he was going to miss pancakes again. Bobby called to the other lumberjacks to help, but it wasn't enough. They couldn't move the log to the river. Hooray! The log was moving. Little by little, it rolled and finally, with a splash, landed in the river. Bobby turned to head back to camp so he could be first for pancakes. But, oh no, as he turned, he saw his log was not moving with the others. Bobby had to do something to move his log along. So Bobby jumped into the river and pulled himself up on the log. He rolled his log slowly at first, and it gradually caught up to the other logs. But the log became slippery from the river, and Bobby was moving too fast to stay on. Suddenly, Bobby's feet slipped off the fast-rolling log, and with a loud splash, he fell into the river. Bobby quickly tied his log to the others, but the river was moving too fast, and Bobby lost his grip. Bobby frantically grabbed onto a log and crawled on top. He was out of the river, but he was even further from camp. The walk would be very long. "I'll never make it to camp in time for pancakes," Bobby sighed sadly. "Hey, Bobby," one lumberjack called out as he pointed to the floating logs. "Just run the boom." Bobby had never done that before. His job was to only cut trees down with his saw and axe. But he thought about those hot, thick pancakes and with a wave, jumped up. Bobby looked ahead at the long line of logs and hesitated. He took a deep breath and started to run across the logs carefully with each step. Bobby nobbled here and slid there as he made his way across the boom. But he could see his friends, and so Bobby started to run faster. With a big leap, he landed with a thud on the bank of the river. "I did it!" Bobby shouted. All around him, the other lumberjacks bellowed, "Yo-ho!" for a job well done. Bobby spotted his axe lying next to the stump of his tree. He picked it up quickly as he followed the heavenly smell of pancakes. As Bobby emerged through the trees, he could finally see his pancakes, towering, fluffy stacks, waiting for all the lumberjacks. Bobby quickly grabbed a plate and filled it high with pancakes. Bobby grinned as he took his first bite, closing his eyes to savor the wonderful taste. "Ah," he sighed, "I'd do anything for pancakes. After all, lumberjacks love pancakes." Aisha's Colors. Every year, during summer vacation, my friends travel to faraway places. My family doesn't go very far at all. Every year, my family takes the same trip. From our home in Jakarta, through the rice paddies, to Grandma's village in the countryside. This year, I wanted to see something new. I wanted to go somewhere different. "My friend Jenny," I said to Mom and Dad, "is going to see snow this year. Snow! I'd like to know what snow feels like. I'd like to know what snow tastes like." Jenny told me that snow is white and crisp and crunchy, and that it melts in your hands. "Well, that gives me an idea," Mom said. "Let's stop for Escampur." Escampur is our favorite treat. We visit the same stall every year. The vendor recognized us right away. "3 Escampur coming right up," he announced, "with pink syrup for you, Aisha." Escampur is white and crisp and crunchy. It's delicious. When we got back on the road, I told Mom and Dad about my friend, Demas. "Every summer, his family stays in a hotel with a pool," I said. "A swimming pool." Demas floats in the turquoise water every day and looks up at a clear blue sky. Take a look out your window, Aisha, Dad said. You'll see lots of pretty blue out there. Whoa! Suddenly, our car rumbled and grumbled and coughed. A cloud of smoke came out of the engine. I'm fed up with this vacation, I cried. I'll figure out what's wrong with the car, Mom said. In the meantime, Aisha, you need to go and cool down. While I was lying on the grass, I thought about my neighbor, Sergrar. Last summer, he visited an aquarium. An aquarium! He saw tropical fish of every color. Pink fish, orange fish, and teeny tiny fish with rainbow scales. I can't even imagine what that looks like. Or can I? Colorful fish-shaped kites were riding the wind. It was beautiful. When we got back in the car, I thought about all the things we'd seen on our way to Grandma's. I've decided that my favorite color might be white, like escampior. Or maybe it's blue, like the ocean. Or a rainbow of colors, like the kites soaring in the sky. Finally, I remembered nothing is more beautiful than Grandma. If I have to pick a favorite color, it's probably yellow. Yellow like sunshine. Yellow like Grandma's soto soup, made with saucy noodles, sour limes, and crunchy veggies. After this vacation, I'm going to stop worrying about what other people's vacations are like and start cherishing all the wonderful colors of mine. Daddy sitting. This is Daddy. Today, I'm Daddy sitting. He likes to get up early and dance and sing. I get him ready. Then I make his favorite breakfast. Daddy is full of energy and needs lots of exercise. Daddy sitting keeps me busy, but I can't watch him every minute. I have lots of jobs to do. Sometimes he doesn't watch where he's going. Sometimes he just needs a little rest. Sometimes he just needs a little love. Daddy is very smart. I tell him he can do anything when he grows up. He could be a lion tamer or an astronaut. He could be a famous chocolate maker or a detective on the case of the missing chocolates. Or a nurse treating children who have eaten too much chocolate. But Daddy doesn't want to be any of those. He wants to do only one job, which is always packed with adventure. Being my Daddy. And maybe an astronaut, but only if we can all be astronauts together. Okay, here's a story about a dog titled Very Lulu, the mostly true story of a training school dropout. Lulu was a free spirit. She loved to spin and roll and lean out the car window. Everywhere that Lulu went, she sniffed out fun. She had a nose for it. Actually, she had a nose for everything. And that was how she ended up here. The Police Dog Academy. Well, said the officer, she's very Lulu, said Lulu's handler. The other dogs were not very Lulu at all. They could count and speak on command and tell left from right. And they only sniffed what they were told to sniff. Lulu sniffed anything she wanted, like donuts, potted plants, and socks. The officer took Lulu's handler aside. Do you really think Lulu has what it takes? She's very... Oh, she's very Lulu, said Lulu's handler. After lunch, the officer decided to have a talk with Lulu. Lulu, can you be more like the other dogs? You don't want to fail, do you? Lulu had not known a dog could fail anything. So she tried. She really did. The other dogs ran obstacle courses, but Lulu was an obstacle. Lulu! The other dogs fetched evidence. Lulu had to be fetched. Lulu! The other dogs tracked scents. Lulu, really Lulu. The officer took Lulu's handler aside. Maybe we should get some help with Lulu. She's very Lulu, said Lulu's handler. Still, they tried. They really did. They brought Lulu treats. They brought Lulu toys. They even brought Lulu someone to talk to. But Lulu was still very Lulu. Mostly, Lulu was beginning to miss her old life. She missed being able to slide and scramble and tug on ropes. She missed sniffing out fun. The officer took Lulu's handler aside. Do you really think this is the job for Lulu? She's very unhappy, agreed Lulu's handler. But I know a job she's perfect for. Being part of my family. And that was how she ended up here. Georgie Dupree, Classroom Confidence. Georgie Dupree usually needs 3 wake-up calls for Mama before pulling the covers from over her head and plopping out of bed. But not today. This is Georgie's first day at Addison Elementary. Her new school is ginormous, and she would be so scared if she had to conquer it alone. Georgie's family moved from Louisiana to Washington, D.C., to live with her Nana. The Jays, her twin brothers, Julian and James, are way too little to go to elementary school. But not me, Georgie thinks with a smirk, I'm not too little at all. Georgie runs outside when she sees her neighborhood friends that she met over the summer, Camilla and Quinn. The kids walk to school here, but Georgie's mama and daddy trail close behind. You are going to love our school, Quinn exclaims. Everyone is so nice, says Camilla. But the truth is, Georgie is a little nervous about her new school. Georgie stops short when she sees kids swarm around the big school building. Unfamiliar faces brush past her with squeaky new shoes. They know exactly where to go, but Georgie doesn't. Big butterflies flap in her stomach. Mama, what if I get lost? What if I don't make any new friends? What if everyone is smarter than me? Georgie asks. You're going to have a great day, Georgie, Mama says, grabbing her hand. It's not like you to be so nervous. It's going to be fun. Is that girl wearing a tutu? A girl with French braids says to another. They both giggle. Oh, no. Georgie loves this outfit, and Camilla loves it, too. Georgie takes a deep breath. Then she walks up the stairs and into the big school building. The main hallway stretches like it could go on for miles. Georgie sees Camilla and Quinn turn right for Mr. Parker's class. But Mama and Daddy escort her to the class on the left with Miss Janes. Oh, no, Georgie's mouth drops. It happened. She is on her own. Georgie gets lost in the click-clacking of Mama's heels as she watches her parents leave the building. She imagines herself running after them, but she stays put. Georgie smooths her outfit, takes another deep breath, and walks through the classroom door. "Here goes nothing," Georgie says under her breath. Daddy always told Georgie to look for something in common when trying to make new friends. She chews her bottom lip as she scans the room. Bingo! She sees another girl with pink shoes. "Hi there, I'm Georgie Dupree, and I just moved here all the way from Louisiana. Do you want to be my friend?" "Hi, Georgie, I'm Maya. I love your pink sparkly shoes. Come meet my friends." "I'm Alex."
"I'm Remy."
Oh no, Georgie spots the French braid girls in her class, and they are staring right at her.
"Welcome, students. My name is Miss Janes, and we start each class by reading our daily affirmation together. An affirmation helps you believe in yourself when you need it most. Every day, I will try my best. I believe in myself and my abilities. No matter how hard it is, I can do it. I will be kind and caring toward my classmates and teacher."
Georgie loves the affirmation. She is so inspired that she even does her own dance to go along with the words. Miss Jane snaps her head around when she hears giggles.
"What's going on here?" asks Miss Jane.
"She did a weird dance," one of the French braid girls burst out laughing. Georgie's cheeks are warm with embarrassment.
"Our daily affirmation says, I will be kind and caring to my classmates and teacher."
"Is laughing at someone kind or caring?" scolds Miss Janes. Georgie's new friends give her comforting smiles, but Georgie still feels hurt. She thought the dance moves were a fun idea. Miss Janes passes around the first assignment of the day. The sound of fast scribbles fills the classroom. In just a couple of minutes, some students are already working on the back of the worksheet. But Georgie is still stuck on question 3. Georgie slowly raises her hand.
"Yes, Georgie, what is it?"
"Miss Janes, I'm not feeling well. I need to go to the nurse."
"Are you sure? All right, go ahead."
Georgie pushes open the door of the nurse's office with her head hanging low.
"Hello there, how can I help you?" asks the nurse.
"Hi, I'm Georgie Dupree. I have a tummy ache."
"Did you eat something funny?"
"No, I'm just not feeling well."
How is your first day of school going?"
"Well, my friends Camilla and Quinn aren't in my class. Some kids made fun of me, and I'm not as smart as everyone else."
Georgie burst into tears.
"Oh, Georgie, the first day of school can be tough, especially when you are a new student."
"You're going to do well, I can already tell. I bet your personality is as bright and sparkly as your shoes."
"You can take a moment here, but then back to class you go. You don't want to miss anything exciting."
Georgie drags her feet and slowly walks back to class, running her hand along the wall the whole way. The hallway doesn't stretch for miles this time. Before she knows it, she is back at her classroom door.
Oh, drats! She arrives just in time for the next activity.
"All right, everyone, now close your eyes," Miss Janes tells the class. "I want you to imagine what you're going to accomplish this school year. I want you to see it, believe it, and embrace it."
Georgie finds herself smiling at the thought of making chalk art with her new friends.
feeling more confident when turning in her assignments, and auditioning for the school play that Camilla told her about. When the final school bell rings, she lets out a sigh of relief. Georgie, we're so proud of you for making it through your first day at your new school. Thanks, Daddy. It wasn't easy, but tomorrow will be better. A couple of kids weren't nice to me, but I made some new friends. Well, I can't imagine anyone who wouldn't want to be friends with you, Georgie, chimes in Nana. Sometimes it takes a little bit longer for some people to see how special you are. That night, Georgie came up with a plan to have her new friends join her in doing the affirmation dance. Maybe then everyone would see how much fun it is and want to join in too. The next morning, Georgie's feet hit the floor even faster than the day before. This day is different. Before Georgie leaves for school, she closes her eyes and imagines what she will accomplish today. She wants to see it, believe it, and embrace it, just like she learned in class. We're sorry you aren't in our class, Georgie, says Camilla. The first day wasn't easy, but today will be better. I can feel it. We are going to do something fun in class today, says Georgie. Bye, Mama. Bye, Daddy. See you later, Georgie says with a big smile. Maya, Remy, and Alex, do you want to do the affirmation dance with me today? I can teach you right now. Georgie and her friends burst into the classroom. When it's time for the daily affirmation, they all join in to do Georgie's dance together. Every day, I will try my best. I believe in myself and my abilities. No matter how hard it is, I can do it. I will be kind and caring toward my classmates and teacher. There are no giggles to be heard this time. Georgie and her friends exchange high fives. At worksheet time, Georgie is not intimidated by the fast scribblers of her classmates. She focuses on her own work, tunes out the noise, and takes her time, even if she takes a little bit longer than others. Georgie beams when she turns in her worksheet. At the end of the day, Georgie receives the most special surprise from her classmates. Hi, Georgie. Your affirmation dance looks like a lot of fun. Can you teach us? Goodness gracious, I would love to, squeals Georgie with pride. Place your hands on your hips. Every day, I will try my best. Point to your chest. I believe in myself and my abilities. Show off your muscles. No matter how hard it is, I can do it. Hold your hands over your heart. I will be kind and caring toward my classmates and teachers. Okay, I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with a picture book titled Basking in My Brown. Sweet Summertime. I love how the warm breeze brings fond memories of days spent flying kites on empty rooftops while visiting Dado in Pakistan. I love the outdoor dinner parties Ami puts together, everyone's kurtas sparkling brilliantly under the twinkling stars. I love swimming in deep, cool water and building castles that are my own. I love climbing trees strong and grand, grown just like me. But most of all, I love basking in the sun. Today, Zoya and I play under a bright blue sky, the sun coating us in gold. We close our eyes and feel the warmth sink in. When the sun is high in the sky, Zoya stands up. I should go in, she sighs. So soon, I ask. My mom says I shouldn't stay out in the sun too long.
That it'll make my skin get too dark, Zoya replies, shaking off the blades of grass that cling to her legs.
Will you go in, too?
I'm going to stay out all day, I proudly declare. I love watching my skin turn all different shades of brown. My mom says the sun makes my skin a magical brown.
A magical brown? Zoya asks.
I hold out my hand. The sun beams down on my skin, basking in my brown.
See how it shimmers?
My skin is brown, like the heavy clay pot from my nanny's stories, filled to the top with cool water. Water she carried in the hot sun for miles and miles to bring back to her family.
Brown, like the shawl that kept Ami warm as she and Abu journeyed above the clouds from their homeland to a land we now call our home.
Brown, like the henna my sister draws on her hands, each pattern special in its own way, soft flowers hugging strong vines.
Brown, like the perfectly round galoob jamuns Kahala makes, dancing in sticky syrup, golden flakes floating on top.
My favorite dessert, sweet and bold with flavor.
Brown, like the packed soil of the cricket pitch, the one where Abu used to play, soil so sturdy and sound.
Brown, like the bangles I wear, they jingle and jangle, singing, I am proud to be me.
My brown skin has its own story.
It is strong.
It is ambitious.
It is bold.
It is soft.
It is fearless.
It is sweet.
It is a beautiful brown.
It is my very own beautiful brown.
Wow, Zoya says in awe. She thinks a moment longer before lying back down in the grass.
I'm staying, she smiles. I like the idea of this magic.
We sprawl our arms and legs out as wide as we can, ready to add to our story and proudly bask in our brown.
Dear beautiful brown girls, never forget who you are and where you came from. It is what makes you special. You are your very own special type of brown. Own it, embrace it, celebrate it, always.
And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading a novel that I've been reading now for a little over 3 months that also happens to be the 2024 Newbery Award-winning book, given to the best children's book every year, titled The Eyes and the Impossible. Johannes is a free dog, a fast dog, such a fast dog. He lives in an urban park by the sea, and every day he runs through the park, seeing all, missing nothing, and reporting what he sees to the park's three ancient bison, the keepers of the equilibrium. But the equilibrium has been disrupted. Mysterious rectangles are hypnotizing Johannes. The humans are erecting a mysterious new building, and an entirely new kind of animal has arrived in the park. And there are hundreds of them. Johannes must run faster, see better, and ultimately do more than run and see. He must liberate those he loves. Okay, last week, Johannes shared his plan to free the three bison from the island with the three bison. They all agreed and asked for Johannes to be the equilibrium. Meredith told Johannes he was a coyote and that his father was the last one on the island and humans are looking for him.
he discovered Bertrand, the pelican, got shot at the archery field, but survived. They pulled the arrow out, but he can no longer fly. Johannes and the bison are now planning how to leave the island with the goats this morning. And that's where I left off last week. Chapter 33. Angus and his time machine were key to making all this work, because the ship left at 7:08, and only he and Helen had any idea what all these number words meant. I knew just that we had to do it in the shortest amount of time in order to maximize the chaos and minimize any possibility that any of the humans could figure out just what was happening in time to stop it all from happening. This is what we were making happen. Well, it started with reconnaissance. Sonia and I had to figure out how many humans were minding the bison that morning. Sometimes there were four, sometimes only one. It was up to us to assess just how many humans we had to handle. There was a light on at the bison enclosure office, so Sonia jumped up to the windowsill and peeked in. She counted one woman sitting at a desk, half asleep with her feet up. Then there was the hammock man, who roamed the perimeter. And this morning we found him, where else, lying in his hammock, strung between two tall pines. We were thinking that this morning's humans were going to be particularly easy to handle when, no, we saw a large vehicle pull up, the lights like white blades slicing through the woods, and four humans emerge. They were the same humans who had been poking and prodding the bison the day before. They were in uniform with khaki pants and black jackets. They left the vehicle and made for the office with great confidence and determination. I looked up at Sonia with a look that said, "Oh, no." And she looked down at me with a look that said, "I know." But whether it was two humans or six, it was about to come down to Angus and Sharif and Johnson and the rest of the raccoons. The raccoons were hiding in a culvert when I came to them to report the human count. Angus was surprised, but not daunted. "So are we biting?" Sharif asked. I hadn't heard anything about biting until that moment, and really didn't want to be part of any biting of humans. It never led anywhere good. Humans are deeply opposed to being bitten, and go to great lengths not to get bit. And they punish the biters without mercy. I expressed my hesitance to Angus and his crew, who told me that my concerns were duly noted, but that they would do what the situation required. "We only bite for justice," Angus said. And I cannot argue with that, bite for justice. It had a certain ring. Now Angus turned to his platoon of black and gray. "Well, we begin at 6:21 in the morning," he said. He turned to me. "That's just a few minutes from now." It seemed that all of the raccoons could tell time now. And by my count, at least three of them had time machines like Angus, were wearing them on their furry wrist, and could read them with casual confidence. I left them there in the culvert, knowing that the next time I heard from them, they would be inciting, we hoped, a lunatic bit of chaos in the parking lot. Now I went to the bison, who were, as planned, in the corner of the enclosure closest to the feeding station. The feeding station had a gate to the outside world. One of the humans used to get into the feeding station. It was common for the bison to gather there in anticipation of being fed. I skulked in the thicket nearby and made a quick little yipping sound that we'd agreed would be my signal that all was a go. Their return signal was to be a nod of the head. which they all did, almost in unison. We were a go. I looked up to Yolanda, who was circling above, and gave her a nod. She let out a loud screech, signaling to everyone else that this thing was beginning. And it began immediately. It began when an alarm sounded from the black vehicle in which the official people had arrived. I looked over to find three raccoons on the vehicle's hood, scratching the paint, and Angus on top, urinating. The four uniformed humans, screaming and flailing, left the Bison office and ran to the car, which was making a deafening noise. "Oh my God! Oh my God!" the humans from the office yelled as they ran to the car. And now one door of the vehicle opened, and the human who got out also yelled, "Oh my God! Oh my God!" and then quickly retreated back inside the vehicle. Now the humans from the office were yelling, "Oh my God! Oh my God!" as they circled the car, not really knowing what to do. The human was safe inside the car, and the office humans were safe at a certain distance. So it was funny for a long moment watching the humans stand yelling, "Oh my God! Oh my God!" while watching the raccoons do their scratching and thumping and urinating, while these humans had no plan to stop it. "Shoo!" roared one human. And I laughed. I should not have laughed because there was so much serious work to do, but I did laugh. The word "shoo" is such a funny one when applied to raccoons, because of all the animals under the sun, the ones least likely to shoo are raccoons. They do not acknowledge the validity of the word. Still, the humans said, "Shoo, shoo," and even the raccoons stopped their scratching and urinating to laugh a bit too. But only for a second, because more distracting needed to be done. As the people approached with their shoes and waving arms, Angus and his friends jumped from the hood and the roof and began a madcap circling of the vehicle, running under it, jumping back onto the hood, anything to keep the humans in their khakis occupied. The one human who was still in the office came out, too, now on her phone. She was no doubt calling the Control the Animals people. We had anticipated this. Now it was time to cut the lights. This was the work of the rats. They wanted to be involved some way in the liberation plan and kept volunteering for various tasks, but we thought it best to limit them to this one key, crucial task, to chew through the electrical wires such that, when the chaos began, there would be no way to shed any light on it. And bless those rats. Just as the madness around the vehicle was at its peak, the lights in the office and around the enclosure all went black. It was still a bit before dawn, so having this period of deepest darkness was essential. And dark it was. So dark. Wonderfully dark. We could see everything, of course, being animals and superior in the ways of sight. But we knew the humans would be utterly lost. "We have a power outage," the office human said into her phone. "And the raccoons seem to be losing their minds." Now I saw the other bison minder, the one who had been in the hammock before. He was walking slowly toward the office woman, slashing the darkness with his flashlight. "What's happening?" he asked. Then his slashing light cut across me. "Ah, the coyote," he yelled and recoiled. "Coyote?" the office human yelled, terror in her voice. "Where?" Now that I was in the dark again, I have to admit that I was a bit scared too. Sure that the coyote must be near me, given the hammock man had said the word immediately after slashing me with his light, I looked around, though, and saw nothing like a coyote. More importantly, I smelled no such creature. And I would have smelled anything new and unprecedented like a coyote 1,000 miles away. It would have overwhelmed my nose. And then I looked down and remembered. "It's gone now," the man said, "but the raccoons are everywhere. They've gone nuts." As he explained the raccoon madness, I waited for the humans to move closer to the vehicle. The humans were still too close to the bison's feeding station. We needed the humans out of eyeshot. Angus must have known this too. He had likely counted the humans who were gathered near the vehicle and knew that two were missing. The raccoon's task was to distract all the humans, to draw them all away from the bison enclosure. But these two humans were hanging tight. He needed a more dramatic act. "Ow! Oh, God! One of them bit me!" One of the khakied people had been bit. And I bet it was Angus who did it. He had bitten for justice, and now this person was shrieking and jumping around, holding his ankle. And finally, the two bison minders went out to the parking lot to help. I'm sorry that this biting happened. It was not my idea. There might have been other ways. But in the moment, Angus acted, and the plan moved forward. With these final two gathered with the others around the still alarming vehicle, and the one still inside it, trying to get the shrieking to end, the next stage of the plan could now begin. With a triple yip, I signaled Sonia to push the bolt of the enclosure door open. Though I could not see her from my vantage point, I could hear its distant tick as the metal moved left to right, and I knew that the door was ajar. I ran to the feeding station and saw that Freya and Samuel and Meredith were slowly and silently making their way out of the gate and into the open park. Oh, wow! Oh, wow! Oh, wow! My friends, I can't tell you the vaulting joy I felt when I saw them pass through that gate, when I saw them drifting through and then away from that metal grind of fencing, leaving that steel cross hatch behind. Oh, wow, it was something far beyond what I imagined. My eyes watered, my throat dried, my heart darted everywhere in my body, from toe to toe and shoulder to shoulder, like a crazed dragonfly trying to escape. But there was no time to dwell on this. It was Sonia's next job to lead the bison away from the enclosure and into the woods and onto the beach. And it was my job to make sure that all went as planned with the horses. Yes, the horses. We needed the horses. As haughty as they are, they were indispensable to this endeavor. With the bison safely away, I ran to the horse stables and told them it was time. And they did their part with gusto. We had carefully selected 3 horses that were closest in size to Freya and Meredith and Samuel. And the horses' role now was to serve as stand-ins for the bison. Moments after the bison left, following Sonia into the woods, I led the horses into the enclosure and to its farthest corner, away from humans, so if they were to look across the field, they would see 3 large lumps, bison-like silhouettes in the distance, huddled together and seemingly asleep. The horses, of course, would not pass for bison upon close inspection, but at a glance, and to buy precious time, they would do. I watched them lope off across the field and settle in the corner, and I thought, well, that is not bad, not at all bad. As they settled into the corner, a siren rose in the distance. Ambulance, I thought. An ambulance for the person Angus bit. Good, I thought. A good distraction. And the person would be fine, for Angus had no diseases or ailments, not even bad breath, which is such a problem with so many of his kind. Now it was time to catch up with Sonia and take her place in leading the bison to the beach. I followed our agreed-upon route, and with my speed, I was soon upon their lumbering parade. "Psst," I said to the rear of Samuel, who was in the rear. "Psst yourself," he said to me, and I jogged quickly around him and to the head of the pack, to Sonia. "How are we doing?" I asked. "Well, so far, so good," she said, and she darted away at a speed I found astonishing. I was always aware that she was quick. Squirrels are quick. You know this, I trust. But I didn't know just how fast she was. She ran off in a straight line to our left, and in seconds was a tiny dot. Then gone entirely. Gone. Surely she was not as fast as I, but still. Her work from here on out was to circle the park, to assess any new people movements, to gauge how effective our horse decoys were, to fix any problems that needed fixing, and alert anyone who needed alerting. With Sonia gone and the smell of the ocean wafting through the trees, I turned to Freya. "Are you ready?" I asked. "Soon we'll be at the windmill, and when we're at the windmill, we'll be among the goats. And when we're among the goats, it'll be time to go." "I know, my son, I know," she said and chuckled. "Do you really think we'll make it? I'm far more nervous than I expected to be." In the dim light, I could just barely make out her eyes, and they did seem disquieted. Behind her, Meredith's breathing was quick, tense, on the verge of hyperventilating. "Don't worry," I said. "Helen will take care of everything." And just as I said it, I wondered if this were true. Helen was capable and bold, but could she really hide three enormous bison among a herd of goats? We did not even know Helen very well. We were basing all this, so much, on a goat we'd just met. That I'd just met, and whom the bison didn't know at all. And hiding enormous bison among relatively tiny goats? Ah, it was all such lunacy. We had not had time to test the story, the theory. We had not had time to worry or calculate or run through problems and solutions. We had only had time to guess at this idea, and now we had to see it through. Chapter 34. We emerged from the densest part of the forest, and now we could see the windmill's silhouette, black against a sky of deepest blue. "I smell the ocean," Freya said. "Wait till you see it," I said. "I'm here," a breathless voice said. "Helen," I asked. "Of course it's Helen," she said. Now she emerged from the darkness and looked over my shoulder, up to the eyes of Freya. "Ma'am," she said. "Hello, Helen," Freya said. "I'm Freya, and this is Meredith, and this is Samuel." "Hello, hello," Helen said, giving them each a quick bow. And just then my chest ached, thinking in mere minutes I would have to say goodbye to Helen. She really was one of my favorite creatures, a thing of rare grace and radical kindness. "Are you feeling ready?" she asked the bison. "I think so," Freya said. But she did not sound ready, and Meredith and Samuel said nothing. I could not see them well, but there was something new coming from them, some shaky pheromone that told me they were tense at best, and at worst terrified. "Follow me," Helen said, and we followed her down through the ice plants and toward what had been the field of tulips, and then, from the tulips, emerged a sea of goats. They had been sleeping, it seemed, and now they rose up, one by one, until we were surrounded by them, and they were already assessing whether or not they could do what they had been asked to do, to surround and hide these mighty bison. "Helen, this is crazy," one said. "Look at me." This goat, whose name was Theo, stood next to Freya, showing just how tiny he was in her shadow. "She's huge," he said, then looked up to Freya. "No offense." The sky was beginning to shed its night cloak. "None taken," Freya said, and I could see in her eyes an exhausted sadness. Meredith and Samuel were looking around them at the goats converging from all sides, and thought they smiled politely. They did not seem to be embracing the moment, did not seem to believe the plan could work. And for a moment, Helen faltered too. I saw something in her eyes, something uncertain, something like fear. "Today," I whispered to her. She lifted her chin. "Today," she said to the goats assembled. "Today, we do something important," I whispered, and she glanced at me. Now her eyes were bright and sure. "Today, we do something new, something important, and something very risky," she roared in a bell-clear voice. Everyone around, the goats, the bison, me, were instantly locked into attention. "It will take total commitment, total belief," she said, louder now. It was as if she had taken the wind from the ocean, had eaten the clouds from the sky. "It will take everything we have." And unfortunately, this is all the time that we have for today. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the fascinating novel titled The Eyes and the Impossible. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.